No one knows what this means, but his point, that he is too insane for everyone else's good, is made. One midnight, there is an uproar. Dogs bark. Axemen request silence. The surveyors are out of their tents, up the track somewhere, taking zenith observations. There is a crowd in front of Dixon's tent. R.C. is caught in the light of Nath McLean's tallow dip, just as the last bit of gold chain, sucked between his lips like a Chinese noodle, disappears. R.C., maybe you're getting too mean to think straight anymore. I thought I heard someone coming. That was us. Shouldn't you have set it down someplace, instead of swallering it? There wasn't time. Now ye've more than ye know what to do with, quips Moses Barnes, to the glee of his companions. Don't you know what it is you swallowed, R.C.? Arch McLean slowly reciprocating his head in wonder. That's 60 years of longitude down there, all the work it's come and gone upon that one problem since Sir Cloudesley Shovel lost his fleet and his life upon the cruel rocks of Scilly. What were my choices? R.C., nearly breathless. The thing was either bewitched by country women in the middle of the night, fire, monthly blood, names of power, or perfected, as might any watch be, over years, small bit by bit, to its present mechanical state, by men in workshops and in the daytime. That was the sexual choice the moment presented, between those two sorts of magic. I had less than one of the creature's ticks to decide, so I took it, and I gobbled it right down. His pink fists swing truculently, and he has begun to pout. Any of you have a problem with this? As the arm of discipline here, I certainly do, declares Mr. Barnes, the overseer of the axemen, for in an expedition into the country, as upon a ship at sea, nothing destroys morale like theft, which, legally speaking, is what this is. Yet anyone may put an ear to his stomach. The watch is sensibly there, nor is he making a secret of it. We might more accurately say an act of sequestration, its owner being denied the use of... Aye, yet absent a conversion to personal use. Oh, Philadelphia, thunders Mr. Barnes, have thy barristers poisoned discourse e'en unto the rude who dwell in this desert? Whatever shall we do? The utterance being Mr. Barnes' cryptic way of requesting it, stone silence falls over the company. Has anyone considered where we are? All know that he means, where just at the tangent point, strange lights appear at night, figures not quite human emerge from and disappear into it, and in the daytime, farm animals who stray too close vanish and do not re-emerge. And why should anyone find it strange that one man has swallowed the watch of another? Some style this place the Delaware Triangle, but surveyors know it as the Wedge. To be born and reared in the Wedge is to occupy a singular location in an emerging moral geometry. Indeed, the oddness of demarcation here, the inscriptions made upon the body of the earth, primitive as designs pricked by an Iroquois with a thorn and a supply of soot upon his human body, a compulsion withal, supported by the most advanced scientific instruments of their day, present to lawyers enough litigation upon matters of property within the Wedge to be coach and six a small pack of them, one generation upon another, yea, into the year 1900 and beyond. By early youth, R.C. had become the kind of mean, ornery cuss his neighbors associated with years of maturity. Here comes old R.C., and don't he look sour today? 'Twas his profession did it to him. As a young surveyor, from the rude shocks attending his first boundary dispute, he understood that he must exercise his art among the most litigious people on earth. Pennsylvanians of all faiths, but most intensely the Presbyterians, hauling each other before justices of the sheriffs, church courts, village quidnuncs, anyone who'd listen, even pretend to, at an unbelievable clip, seeking recompense for ill-treatment, grand and petty. If he wished to pursue this line of work, he would have to recognize the countrywide fiduciary edge of right procedure he might profit whilst retaining his sanity. He infuriated the more bookish surveyors with his approach, which included avoiding paperwork, walking the terrain, and making non-instrumental guesses. Looks about 88-30 to me. Here, eyes shut, arms straight out to his sides, then swept together till the fingertips touched. Eyes open. That's it. How so? By eye, he twinkled sourly. Most of these out here round the Wedge, ye can do by eye. By the time he turned his hand to the problem of the tangent line, it seemed but an accustomed madness in a different form. The geometric whimsicality of kings, this time, and kings to be. In the months, and then the years, after he swallows the watch, as the days of ceaseless pulsation pass one by one, R.C. learns that a small volume within him is, and shall be, immortal. His wife moves to another bed, and soon into another room altogether, after persuading him first to build it onto the house. "Snoring's one thing, R.C. I can always do something about that," brandishing her elbow. "But that ticking..." "Kept me awake, too, at first, Phoebe, but now it rocks me to sleep." "Best wishes, R.C. "Oh, suit yourself." R.C. can act as sentimental as the next young husband, but his public roles require him to be distant and disagreeable. Besides, since he swallowed the watch, she's been noticeably less merry with him, as if cautious in its presence. "Do you imagine it cares what we're doing out here in the world outside?" "Say, Phoebe, do be a peach and come." "But, R.C., it might be..." "What?" His voice beginning to pitch higher. "Listening?" "Taking it all down somehow." "You're the girl I married. Damn me if you're not." He knows she never quite sees what this means, and, being none too sure himself, he never offers to explain it. "'Tis a national treasure," declares Mr. Shippen, "and whoever may first remove it from its present location shall enter most briskly upon the stage of world business. There, will he, nil he, to play his part. All at the price of your own life, R.C., of course, chirurgical extraction and all, but that's business, as they say in Philadelphia." "I'll chuck it up. Why don't I do that?" putting his finger down his throat. "Oh, may we watch?" cry the children. "Never say watch to your father," advises Mrs. R.C. "Arr!" The finger comes out bleeding. "Something bit me." "Likely trying to protect its territory," his eldest son assures him. "How could it bite me? 'Tis in my stomach. 'Tis a watch." "Alter its shape, maybe. Who knows what's happening to it in there? Where all is a drip, disgusting and mushy with chewed up food, and acid and bile, and it smells ever of vomit. Ew." "Enjoy yourselves, children, even at the expense of your poor, suffering old father. If you're that desperate for merriment, no matter, go, mock. Too soon will equal inconvenience befall ye, every one. 'Tis life." "We'll not go swallowing watches, thank ye. Not if you want to sneak up on an Indian some day, you won't." "Hadn't planned on it, Pa." "Figures he'll cash in on longitude. Instead, he eats the chronometer. Some zany dreamer I married." Of course Dixon has to tell Emerson. For weeks after the express has curvetted away, he mopes about, as gloomy as anyone's ever seen him. "I was supposed to look after it." "You wished release from your promise," Mason reminds him. "Think of R.C. as force majeure." The letter, in reply, proves to be from Mrs. Emerson. "When he received your news, Mr. Emerson was quite transformed, and whooping with high amusement, attempted whilst in his workroom to dance a sort of jig, by error stepping upon a lattice that was there, the result being that he has taken to his bed, where, inches from my quill, he nevertheless wishes me to say, 'Felicitations, fool, for it hath worked to perfection.' I trust that in a subsequent my friend will explain what this means." There is a postscript in Emerson's self-schooled hand, exclamatory, ending upon a long, quill-crunching stop. "Time is the space that may not be seen." Upon which the Reverend cannot refrain from commenting. He means that out of mercy we are blind as to time, for we could not bear to contemplate what lies at its heart. Chapter 33. "Hope to have your company at the bridge," writes Benjamin Chew to the surveyors. He means Mary Janvier's at Christiana Bridge, where the line commissioners find merry pretext to gather, gossip, swap quids and quos, play whist, drink Madeira, sing catches, sleep late, or else stay up till the northbound mail coach wheels in at 7 a.m., and the passengers all come piling out for breakfast at the Indian Queen. Never know whom you'll run into. An hour's pause in the journey, wherein early risers may practice, each day, upon a different set of travelers. Flirting, cards, coffee and chatter, the hope is for a productive, when not amusing, hour. At this pleasant waterside resort, gulls sit as if permanently upon posts, Ducks enjoy respite from the attentions of fowlers. The mild haze thins and thickens. Sandwiches and ale arrive in a relaxed and contingent way. Official business is taken care of quickly to make available more time for drink, smoke, and jollification. Yet, whilst the Marylanders, attuned to leisure, take the time as it comes, the gentlemen from Philadelphia, their watches either striking together with eerie precision every quarter hour, or when silent, forever being consulted and repocketed, must examine for productivity each of their waking moments, as closely as some do their consciences, unable quite to leave behind them the species of time peculiar to that city, best expressed in the almanacal sayings of Dr. Franklin. In the summer, toward evening, thunder gusts come slashing down off the Allegheny front, all the way riding close above the trees, flaring either side in wet and bright waves upon each arrival of the lightning, over Juniata, then Susquehanna, tapping at the windows of Harris Ferry, skidding across the shake roofs of Lancaster, and soaking the town. And on to Chesapeake and 1,000 tributaries, each in its humid, stippled turmoil, and the inn, and the gentlemen indoors at their merriment, whilst ducks of all sorts, lounging in the weather as if 'twere sunshine, fly into a frenzy at each blast of lightning and thunder, then, immediately forgetting, go back into their pluvial comforts. Though all are welcome here, Janvier's, like certain counterparts in Philadelphia, has ever provided a venue for the exercise of proprietarian politics. By a curious assortment of city Anglicans and Presbyterians, with renegade Germans or Quakers appearing from time to time. Especially upon nights before and after voting, the rooms contain a great ridotto of hopeful cupidity. Strangers are viewed suspiciously. Mr. Franklin's confusion is toasted more than once. Rumors circulate that the anti-proprietarians have a Jesuit device for seeing and hearing through walls. The bar seems to vanish in the distance, hewn from some gigantic tropical tree of a vivid deep brown wood all through, further carved and waxed to an arm-pleasing smoothness, comfortable as a bed. No one has yet counted how many it can accommodate, though some have sworn to over 100. Environed by a moderately colored colonial wallpaper, tropical blooms with vermilion petals and long writhing stamens and pistils of indigo, against a field of duck green, not to mention reliable magenta, the pulse of the province ever reciprocates, a quid for a quo, a round for a round, and ever another chance to win back the bundle one has wagered away. And somewhere sure, the raising of voices in debate political. Observe no further than the walls of London. A harsh winter, a cold spring, a dry summer, and no king. Not Boston, sir, but London. Your precious Teutonical dispensation, dammy, means even less upon these shores, sir. I would say the devil take it were he not already quite in possession. Treason, sir. Mr. Dixon cordially. Now then, sir. Peace, astrologer. Astronomer, if it please you, corrects Mr. Mason, without quite considering. At least I am about my business in the honest light of God's day. What is to be said of men who so regularly find themselves abroad at midnight? The pious gentleman has worked himself into a state of heedless anger. Is it the innocent roasted berry that has put them all in such a surly humor? No one else in the room is paying much notice, being each preoccupied by his own no less compelling drama. Smoke from their bright pale pipes hangs like indoor fog, through which, a glimmering, the heavy crockery and silverware claps and rings. Servant lads in constant motion carry up from the cellar coffee sacks upon their shoulders or crank the handles of gigantic coffee grinders as the assembly clamors for cup after cup of the invigorating liquid. By the end of each day, finely divided coffee dust will have found its way by the poundful up the nostrils and into the brains of these by then alert youths, lending a feverish edge to all they speak and do. Conversing about politics under such a stimulus would have proved animated enough, without reckoning in as well the effects of drink, tobacco, whose smoke one inhales here willy-nilly with every breath, and sugar, to be found at every hand in loosened brown cones, great and little, iced cupcakes by the platterful, all manner of punches and flips, pies of the locality, crullers, muffins, and custards. No table that does not hold some sweet memento, for those it matters to, of the cane thickets, the chains, the cruel sugar islands. a sweetness of immorality and corruption, pronounces a Quaker gentleman of Philadelphia, bought as it is with the lives of African slaves, untallied black lives broken upon the greedy engines of the Barbados. Sir, we wish no one ill. We are middling folk. Our toil is as great as anyone's, and some days it helps to have a lick of molasses to look forward to at the end of it. If we may refuse to write upon stamped paper, and for the tea of the East India Company find a tolerable succeeding name in New Jersey Red Root, might philosophy not as well discover some patriotic alternative to these vile crystals that eat into our souls as horribly as our teeth? Every day the room, for hours together, sways at the verge of riot. May unchecked consumption of all these modern substances at the same time, a habit without historical precedent, upon these shores be creating a new sort of European, less respectful of the forms that have previously held society together, more apt to speak his mind, or hers, upon any topic he chooses, and to defend his position as violently as need be. Two youths of the macaronic profession are indeed greatly preoccupied upon the boards of the floor, in seeking to kick and pummel, each into the other, some enlightenment regarding the topic of virtual representation. An individual in expensive attire, impersonating a gentleman, stands upon a table, freely urging sodomitical offenses against the body of the sovereign, being cheered on by a circle of mechanics who are not reluctant with their own suggestions. Wenches emerge from scullery dimnesses to seat themselves at the tables of disputants, and in brogues thick as oatmeal, recite their own lists of British sins. The attempt to relieve Fort Pitt continues, as do reverberations from the massacres at Conestoga and Lancaster. All to the west is a surge and a flame. Wagons from over Susquehanna appear at all hours of day and night, pots and kettles, sacks of corn, the babies and the pig riding inside. 'Tis the year 55 all over, and the panicked era just after Braddock's defeat. The smell of a burned cabin grows familiar again, the smell of things that are not supposed to be burned, women's things, house things. Detecting it, if one's approach happens to be from downwind, is ever the first order of business. The stargazers are well away from events. On the 8th of January, 31 miles more or less due west of the southernmost point of Philadelphia, they begin setting up their observatory at John Harlan's farm. "You'll not wreck my vegetable patch," Mrs. Harlan informs them. "We are forbidden, good woman, as a term of our contract and commission, to harm gardens and orchards. We'll set up in a safe place. Pay ye fair rent, of course." "Welcome, one and all," cries Mr. Harlan. "Ye fancy the vegetable patch? Why, ye shall have it too. We'll buy our vegetables." Playfully swinging at her husband with the spade she holds, "Why here, sirs?" "Because your farm lies exactly as far south from the pole as the southernmost point in Philadelphia," Mason informs them. "'Tis the same latitude's what you mean. Then so's a great line of farms, east and west, why choose mine? Why not my neighbor Tumblings, who has more land than he knows what to do with anyway?" "Exactly 15 miles due south of here," Dixon gently, "we'll want to set up another post. 'Twill mark the zero point, or beginning, of the west line. The point here in your field will tell what its longitude is, as well as the latitude of the south edge of Philadelphia. It ties those two facts together, you see." "That wasn't my question." "Mr. Tumbling fired his rifle at us," says Dixon. "And what made you think I wouldn't?" "We gambled, suppose Mason and Dixon." "I'll just fetch down the rifle," offers Mrs. Harlan. Harlan is frowning. "Wait, why didn't you lads measure south from Philadelphia first and then come west?" "Going south first, we should have had to cross the Delaware into New Jersey," Mason explains, "and when 'twas time to turn west, 15 miles down, the same river by then become much enlarged, to cross back over it would have presented a task too perilous for the instruments, if not to the lives of this party. All avoided by keeping to dry land. Hence, first west and then south." "And at the end of your last chain," says Mrs. Harlan, "here we are." She goes off waving her hands in the air, and her husband will be getting an earload soon. Overnight, in John Harlan's field, appears an organized company of men performing unfamiliar rituals with machinery that may as well have been brought from some other inhabited world. Aye, Dixon agrees, the planet London, and its principal moon, nodding at Mason, Greenwich. The farmer can hear them at midnight, when a whisper will carry a mile, as in the daytime, conversing like ship captains through speaking trumpets. Numbers, words that sound like English but make no sense. Of course, he starts finding reasons to go back there and look about. He comes upon the astronomers scribbling by beeswax light before a tent pitched beneath a wave-like slope in the earth, a good sledding hill, part field, part woods, this being a region of such mariform grades. They have been bringing the instrument into the meridian. Because of the way Earth spins, Mason explains, the stars travel in arcs upon the sky. When each arrives at the highest point of its arc, so are you, observing it in the instant, looking perfectly northward along your meridian. So the trick would be knowing when it gets to that highest point. And for that, we have the equal altitude method. We are waiting just at the moment upon Capella. Have a look. Harlan slouches down beneath the eyepiece. Thought this was meant to bring him nearer. The moon, says Dixon, planets, not the stars. Of a star, Mason adds, we wish to know but where it is and when it passes some reference. That's it? Well, of course, one must manipulate the various screw settings precisely, read the Nonius, and 100 details besides I'd but bore you with. Seems fairly straightforward. This moves it up and down. Bring Capella to the horizontal wire, suggests Dixon. Hey, Mason, in a tone not as vexed as it might be, who's the certified astronomer here? Child's play, murmurs Mr. Harland, handling the adjusting screws and levers with a respect both Mason and Dixon immediately note. Thou take the time it crosses the wire rising, and then the time it crosses when setting. The time exactly halfway between is the time it crossed the meridian. This one's not rising. Deed, 'tis gone below the line. 'Tis the lens. Everything in the image we see is inverted. The sky turned upside down? Wondrous! You are allowed to do this? We're paid to do this, declares Dixon. Kings pay us to do this, adds Mason. 'Tis like a job where you work standing upon your head, marvels John Harland. He steps back, gazing upward, comparing the creation as seen by the naked eye with its telescopic counterpart. I am unsteady with this. Knowing the time of culmination, allowing for how fast or slow the clock's going, we may compute the time of the next such culmination, be out there the next night, and upon the tick, turn the instrument down to the horizon, direct an assistant bearing a lantern till the flame be bisected by the vertical wire, have him drop a bob line there and mark the place. And that's north. That's what you were roaring about through those horns all night? Why, what else? Are you looking into futurity? Is it what your neighbors believe? What they hope, aye. Would that we were. Yet this is when he grows shy of regarding them directly, as if it might be dangerous to risk more than sidelong glances. By February, they have learned their latitude closely enough to know that the sector is set up 356.8 yards south of the parallel that passes through the southernmost point of Philadelphia, putting them about 10.5 seconds of arc off. You'll be moving the observatory, I collect, says Mr. Harland. No need to. We'll merely remember to reckon in the offset. In March, a company of axemen, using Polaris to keep their meridian, clear a visto from John Harland's farm 15 miles true south to Alexander Bryant's farm. How can Harland not go along? The wife is less enchanted. John, are you crazy? All this moon beaming about, and it's past time to be planting. Over at Tumbling's, they've got it tilled already. You plant it, Betts, Harland replies, and rent out what you don't. This means 5 shillings every day I work. Silver. British. Real as any spade. You do it. You know how. You do fine. I've seen you. Just don't put in too many of them damn flowers is all. He will come north again to find she's taken a neat square acre and planted it to sunflowers, soon spread without shame upon the hill slope, a disreputable yellow that people will see for miles. In its re-reflected glow in the corner of the field and back, a newly set chunk of rose quartz is shining strangely. At certain times of the day, the sun will catch the pink grain just right, and ah, you might be transported beneath the sea, under the northern ice. Here is Harland among the sunflowers, having romantic thoughts for the first time. Betts notices it. He has changed. He has been out running lines into the distance when once Brandywine was far enough, and now he wants the West. The meaning of home is therefore changed for them as well, as if their own fields had begun, with tremendous smooth indifference, to move in a swell of possibility. In April, Mason and Dixon, using fur rods and spirit levels, measure exactly the 15 miles southward, allowing for the 10.5 seconds off at the north end. In May, they find their new latitude in Mr. Alexander Bryant's field, then remeasure the line northward again. Think of it, Dixon suggests, as a chain man's version of turning the sector. By June, having found at last the latitude of their east-west line, 39 degrees, 43 minutes, 17.4 seconds, they are instructed to proceed to the middle point of the peninsula between Chesapeake and the ocean to begin work upon the tangent line. By the end of the month, they have chained north from the middle point to the banks of the Nanticoke. One reason given for bringing Mason and Dixon into the boundary dispute was that nobody in America seemed to have had any luck with this fiendish problem of the tangent line, which had absorbed the energies of the best geometers in the colonies for more years than would remain to some, their lives to the great cypress swamp a forfeit claimed. Field parties had gone out in 50, 60, and 61, ending up east and west of previous tangent points by as much as 0.4 miles. 'Twas infuriating. 'Twas like tickling a fly under its wing pit with a long and wobbly object such as a fishing pole. The idea was to start from the exact middle point of the Delaware Peninsula, defined quite early in the dispute as the middle point, and run a line north till it just touched the arc of a circle of 12 miles radius centered upon the spire of the courthouse in Newcastle, swung from the shore of Delaware around counterclockwise westward till it meets its tangent line. That's presuming there was a tangent line there to meet it, and so far there wasn't. The problem seemed intractable. From the middle point, you wanted to somehow project a line about 80 miles northward through swamp and swamp inhabitants that would at the far end just kiss at a single tangent point the 12-mile arc, making a 90-degree angle with the radius drawn from the courthouse spire out to that point. Somebody must have imagined the tangent as some perfect north-south line, some piece of meridian that would pass through the middle point and be exactly 12 miles from Newcastle at the same time. But it couldn't do that and run true north, too. 'Twas more royal geometry, fanciful as ever. Any line from the middle point one wished to end up tangent to the 12-mile arc would have to be aimed about 3.5 degrees west of true north. Not only did this arc pass too far west, but it also failed to reach far enough north to touch 40 degrees latitude, which was the northern boundary of the Baltimore's grant from Charles II, thus making of the lower counties an exclave of Pennsylvania inside Maryland. Yet how could either king have foretold that the younger William Penn might wish the lower counties one day contiguous with upper Pennsylvania? So was it drawn. Then everyone waited for the astronomers from London to come and verify the rude colonial's work. For every surveyor who forsook his hearthside in the weeks of chill when the crops were in and the leaves were flown and sights were longer, to go out into the brush and actually set up, out of pure speculation, where there might be a few square inches of dry land, and try to turn the angles and obtain the star shots, getting in addition snake bit, trapped in sucking mud, lost in fog, frozen to the marrow, harassed by farmers and visited by sheriffs. For every such field man there were dozens of enthusiastic amateurs, many of them members of the clergy, who, from the comfort of their fires, sent the commissioners an unceasing autumn wind full of solutions, which came in upon foolscap and elephant and privately watermarked stock, fluttering in the doors, drifting into corners. You'd have thought it was Fermat's last theorem, instead of a county line that looked like a finial upon something of Mr. Chippendale's. Yes, well, of course, that's a question of taste. But look at the way it leans, just enough to be obvious. Honestly, Cedric, it's so predictably colonial, as if, oh, they don't even know how to find north over there. well, we must send our royal astronomers to tidy things up, mustn't we, sort of thing, when in fact it's once more the dead hand of the second James, who went about granting all this geometrically impossible territory, as unreal in a surveying way as some of the other fictions that governed that unhappy monarch's life. Or, once upon a time, as the Reverend retells it for Bree, there was a magical land called Pennsylvania. In settlement of a debt, it was conveyed to William Penn by the Duke of York, who later became James II. And James had been granted the land by his brother Charles, who at the time was king. To understand their thinking, however, would require access to whatever corner of the Vatican Library houses the heretic section. And therein the concept, spoken of in hushed tones, when at all, of stupiditas regia, or the stupidity of kings. And queens, of course, O alarmed tenebrae, not to mention princesses. Yes, stupidity even afflicts those you would think perfect, creatures as well. How so? Tenebrae coolly carrying on with her acufloral meditations. There have, I'm sure, been non-stupid princesses, indeed a good many, uncle. Whereas kings and princes are so stupid, they pretend maps that can't be drawn and style them Pennsylvania. Picking up a fescue, she leans toward the map upon the wall, recourse to which over the years has settled no one knows how many such disputes. King Charles begins at a meridian line, somewhere out in the untraveled forests here, 5 degrees of longitude west of Delaware Bay. Then this not very learned brother finds the point where his desolate meridian crosses the 40th parallel of north latitude. 'Tis, of course, in a huge blank space on the map, here. At the southwestern and least accessible corner of the grant, where, at this remote intersection of parallel and meridian, is to be anchored the entire scheme. Running eastward from there, the royal brothers expect the 40-degree line somewhere to encounter James' 12-mile arc about Newcastle. Oh, 12 miles ought to do it. We don't want to say 13 because that's so unlucky. 14 would engross for you, head of elk, Charles observes, but 'twould push too far west, this vertical line here. The tangent line, sir. I knew that. Charles and James, the Reverend sighing, and their tangle of geometric hopes that somehow the arc, the tangent, the meridian, and the west line should all come together at the same perfect point, where, in fact, all is failure. The arc fails to meet the 40-degree north parallel. The tangent fails to be part of any meridian. The west line fails to begin from the tangent point, being 5 miles north of it. Indeed, a spirit of whimsy pervades the entire history of these Delaware boundaries, as if in playful refusal to admit that America in any way may be serious. The Calvert agents keep coming up with one fanciful demand after another, either trying to delay and obstruct as long as possible the placing of the markers, or else, someone must suggest, giddy with what they imagine escape into a geometry more permissive than Euclid here in this new world. During the negotiations, Marylanders suggest locating the exact center of Newcastle by taking a sheet of paper showing a map of the town, trimming round the edges till only the town remains, and then shifting this about upon the point of a pin till it balances, and at that center of gravity pricking it through as being the true center of the town. Yet if the 12-mile arc be taken as the geometrical expression of the Duke of York's wish to preserve from encroachment his seat of government, then must there project a literal sphere of power from the spire atop the State House, whose intersection with the earth is the arc, unalterably circular, not to be adjusted by so much as a link to agree with any tangent line. Obliged, for meetings with the commissioners, to sleep in Newcastle a night or two, the surveyors discover the will of the second James at close hand. South, though not far enough, lie the bay and the open sea. Before subsiding to perhaps but a single deep hour of stillness broken by no more than the voices of frogs and the stirring of the salt fens, the sounds dominating the fallen night are the cries of sailors behind the doors of taverns and the jingling and drone of the music that pleases them. The hypnagogic citizenry lie wondering if these sailors, some of whose ships carry guns, would defend the town should some Catholic warship, or more than one, advance upon them, torches flaming black and greasy, ejaculations in languages unfathomable. Spanish privateers, and Frenchmen too, their hosts are pleased to relate, were used to come up the river, bold as crows, to attack the little villages and plantations. We never felt as secure at night as you in Philadelphia. Any seaborne assault upon that city would mean first the reduction of Newcastle, for 'tis the key to the river. Now it is difficult to remember, but 15 years ago, in the era of Don Vicente Lopez, there was an apprehensive edge in this town as soon as the sun went down, that did not grow dull till dawn. Though by day the busy capital of the de facto province of Delaware, with nightfall we became a huddled cluster of lights trembling into the coming hours, from lanterns, candles, and hearths, each an easy target upon the humid shore. Many of us adopted forms of nocturnal behavior more typical of New York, staying up the night through, less out of the desire to transgress than the fear of sleeping any time other than in the daylight hours. The great scepter atop the courthouse continues in the dark to radiate its mysterious force. The stock are gone to sleep. The fish and the wine were excellent. Rooms fill with tobacco smoke. Insomnia and headaches abound. Cards emerge from cherrywood recesses. Occupants of the houses along the river stir among the lumps in their mattresses, ready at any alarm to wake. Their dreams are of Spanish visitors who turn out to be unexpectedly jolly, with courtly ways, rolling eyes, passionate guitars, and not a homicidal thought in the boatload of them. Everyone ends up at an all-night ridotto with piles of mysterious, delectable Mediterranean food. Sandwiches made of entire loaves stuffed with fried sausages and green peppers, eggplants, tomatoes, cheese melted everywhere, fresh melons mysteriously preserved through the voyage, wines whose grapes are descended from those that supplied Bacchus himself. Newcastle dreams, drooling into and soaking pillows, helpless before the rapacious, festive fleet. How swiftly might the popish scourge descend, another Don Vicente, havoc's friend, another vile and ringleted senor, another insult to our sovereign shore. Timothy Tox, Pennsylvaniad. Through July they continue north, through swamps, snakes, god-awful humidity, thunder gusts at night, trees so thick that even with 30 axemen, each chain's length seems one with labor incommensurate, waking each glaucous dawn into sweat and stillness to struggle another day with no confidence that at the correct distance they will pass anywhere near the tangent point, much less touch it exactly. On paper, the tangent line's inclination reminds Dixon of the road between Catterick and Binchester. In fact, on up to Lanchester, though one had to look for it, part of the Roman's great north road. To amuse himself in his less mindful moments, he would travel out to the old Roman ruins above the weir and sight southward down the middle of the road, for it ran straight ahead as a shot. Nothing so clear or easy as that in Delaware, however. Dixon mutters to himself all shift long, "If we set up over there, then this great bloody tree's in the way. Yet if we wish to be clear of the tree for any sight longer than arm's length, we must stand in glare of uncertain depth, looking withal from light into shadow." "I appreciate it," says Mason, "when you share your innermost thought processes with me in this way, almost as if, strangely, you did trust me." After these months, who would? In August, they finally go chaining past the 81-mile mark, which they figure puts them a little beyond the tangent point, wherever it is back there. They take September, October, and November to find it, as nicely as art may achieve, computing offsets and measuring them, improving the tangent line by small tweaks and smoothings, until they can report at last that the 90-degree angle required between the tangent line and the 12-mile radius from the courthouse to the tangent point is as perfect as they can get it, which means, as it will prove, off by 2 feet and 2 inches, more or less. In December, they discharge the hands and pause for the winter at Harlan's at Brandywine. "To a good year's work," Dixon, raising a pewter can of new cider, "and pray for another." "To repetition and routine, from here to the end of it," Mason gesturing reluctantly with his claret glass, "even so, more festive than he's been for a while." "Routine? Not likely. Not upon the West Line. Who knows what'll be out there? Each day impossible to predict. Hey, pure adventure." "Thank ye, Dixon. A comfort as ever. Yes, the total blindness in which we must enter that desert might easily have slipped my mind, allowing me a few pitiable seconds' respite from thoughts of it. How welcome! Alas, 'twas not to be, was it? At least nowhere in range of your voice." Oh, dear. Imagined I'd been taking rather the jolliest of tones, actually. My, how awkward for you. Another holiday flare-up, of many preceding, which at first had sent Harlins of all ages cringing against the walls or scrambling up the ladder, yet soon subsided to but one more sound of untamed nature to be grown used to out here, like thunder or certain animal mimicries at night from across a creek. Each time the surveyors apologize for their behavior, then, presently, are screaming again. Apologize, scream. Apologize, scream. Daily life in the Harland house grows jagged. After a Christmastide truce, with the rest of the winter waiting them, perhaps more of it than any can imagine themselves surviving without at least one serious lapse in behavior, the surveyors decide to travel to Lancaster, perhaps in hopes that the imps of discord will fail to pursue them across Susquehanna. Chapter 34. Lancaster Town lies 35 miles journey to the west. What brought me here, Mason wrote in the field record, was my curiosity to see the place where was perpetrated last winter the horrid and inhuman murder of 26 Indians, men, women, and children, leaving none alive to tell. Me, notes Uncle Ives, my, sounds like Mason went by himself. The Reverend nods. Dixon told me that Mason had meant to go alone, but that at the last moment, mindful of the dangers attending solitude in a town notorious for atrocity, he offered to add muscular emphasis, though Mason seemed unsure of whether he wanted him there or not. They, presume they, crossed Susquehanna by Wright's Ferry, reaching Lancaster 10 January 1765, putting up at the Cross Keys. The public rooms are crowded with lawyers, town officials, justices, merchants, and mill owners. The middling to better sort, not a murderously drooling backwoodsman in sight. Unless they include their guide, picked up about a minute and a half inside the town limits, who may once or twice have undergone a loss of salivary control. Mason soon enough on about how quaint, how American, Dixon rather suspecting him of being in the pay of the Paxton boys, to keep an eye upon two hirelings of their landlord and enemy, Mr. Penn. Here for a look at the massacre site, are you, gentlemen? I can always tell. Some bring sketching books, some easels, others their specimen bags, but all converge through the same queer magnetism. I quite understand, though others about may not. 'Twould do to mind one's belongings, yet I must not bite the backs that ignore me. The first stop upon any tour is acknowledged to be the Dutch Rifle, whither the boys, hushed be the name ever spoken, having left their horses at Mr. Slough's, repaired just before the doing of the deed. Step this way, praise. When they see what is upon the tavern sign, Mason and Dixon exchange a look. The weapon depicted black upon white is notable for the device upon its stock, a silver star of 5 points, reversed so that 2 point up and 1 down. A sure sign of evil at work, universally recognized as the horns of the devil. No one would adorn a firearm with it who was not wittingly in the service of that prince. This is not the first time the surveyors have seen it. At the Cape, usually right side up, it is known as the steer loop, a sort of good luck charm out in the bush. But every now and then, mostly on days of treacherous wind or ill spirits, one or both had spied upon a rifle an inverted star, much like what they observe now, against the sky, plumb in the windless forenoon. "I told ye the last time, that last time was the last time, Jabez," comes a voice from a high angle. Mason and Dixon, peering upward, observe the landlord, whose pate appears to brush the beams above him in a vexed temper. "Ever a merry quip," cries Jabez, nimbly stepping behind the surveyors and propelling them in ahead. They are examined skeptically. "Not from the press, are you?" "On my word," cry both surveyors at once. "Drummers of some kinds, my guess," puts in a countryman, his rifle at his side. "Am I right, gents?" "What'll we say?" mutters Mason urgently to Dixon. "Oh, do allow me," says Dixon to Mason. Adverting to the room, "Why, aye, right as a right angle. We're out here to ruffle up some business with any who may be in need of surveying London style. Astronomically precise, optically up to the minute, surprisingly cheap. The behavior of the stars is the most perfect motion there is, and we know how to read it all, just as you'd read a clock face. We have lenses that never lie, and micrometers fine enough to subtend the width of a hair upon a Martian's eyeball. This looks like a bustling town, plenty of activity in the land trades. Where think you should be a good place to start? With an amiability that Mason recognizes as peculiarly Quaker, friendly business. Then why are you asking Jabez about the massacre? Inquires a toothless old coot with an empty can, which Dixon makes sure is promptly filled. Aye, how do we know you're not just two more Philadelphia fops out skipping through the brushwood? He approached us, Mason protests. We're men of science, Dixon explains, this being a neoclassical instance of the catastrophic resolution of interpopulational cross-purposes. Of course, we're curious to see where it all happened. You can't just come minuating in from London and expect to understand what's going on here, advises Mr. Slough. This is about family, sure as the history of England. Inside any one tribe of Indians, they're all related, see? Kill you one Delaware, you affront the family at large. Out here, if it's blood of mine, of course I must go out and seek redress, though I'll have far less company. Each alone lacking the numbers, our sole recourse is to band together. These were said to be harmless, helpless people, Dixon points out in some miraculous way that does not draw challenge or insult in return. Apprehensive among these folks, Mason, who would have perhaps used one adjective fewer, regards his Geordie partner with a strange gaze, bordering upon respect. They were blood relations of men who slew blood relations of ours, Jabez explains. Then if you know who did it, for the Lord's sake, why did you not go after them? This hurt them more, smiles a certain oily Leon, fingering his frizzen and flint. Aye, they go on living, but without dear old Grandam. Puts a big hole in the blanket, don't it? You must hate them exceedingly, Mason pretending to a philosophical interest actually far more faint than his interest in getting out of here alive. No, looking about as if puzzled, not any more. That debt is paid. I'll live in peace with them, happy to. Mayn't they now feel obliged to come after you? Asks Jerry, disingenuous. He notices Mason just visibly creeping toward the door. Not this side of the river, nor this side of York and Waldemar Road. 'Tis all ours now. They answer to us here. What's the complaint? Demands oily Leon. We're out here as a picket for Philadelphia. We've cleared them a fine safe patch from Delaware to Susquehanna. Now may they prance about as foolish as they may. Aye, pens, handing us and our children about like chattel. Dammy, like field slaves. Dared they ever leave England and come here, they should find harsher welcome than any king. Here's a riddle. If a cat may look at a king, may a Pennsylvanian take aim at a king's enforcer? Sir, the murmuring is about equally divided as to whether this is going too far or not far enough. Their cities allow them folly. A German of mystical toilet advises the astronomers that daily living upon the frontier will not forgive. They feed one another's pretenses, live upon borrowed money as borrowed time, their lives as their deaths put, with all appearance of willingness, under the control of others mortal as they, rather than subject, as must country people's lives and deaths be, to the one eternal ruler. That is why we speak plainly, whilst cits learn to be roundabout as snakes. Our time is much more precious to us. What? Our time not precious? Guffaws a traveling sales representative. Why, you're welcome, cousin, to try and get through 24 hours of Philadelphia time, which, if it don't kill you, will cure you, at least, of your illusions about us. Excuse me, says Dixon, I meant to ask, what's thy smoking object in thy mouth that thou keep puffing on? Not much tobacco where you boys are from? Down Chesapeake, why, they've nothing but... Endless acres, Glasgow shipping fender to fender in the bays. Why, Tobo, hell, they use it for money. Smoke your week's pay. This form of it, sir, is what we call a cigar. They come in all sorts, this particular one being from Conestoga. The wagon bullies there style it a stogie. The secret's in the twist they put into the handful of leaves whilst they're squeezing it into shape. Sort of like putting rifling inside a barrel, only different. Gives the smoke a spin, as ye'd say. Watch this. He sets his lips as for a conventional or toroidal smoke ring, but out instead comes a ring like a length of ribbon closed in a circle, with a single twist in it, possessing thereby but one side and one edge. Uncle, pray ye. 'Tis true I was not there, yet such was the pure, original stogie in its day. Though nothing much has been said, the surveyors are surprised to discover that everyone's been saying it for several hours. The only thing that has grown clearer is Jabez's motive in offering to be their guide. Soon lamps are lit and the supper crowd has come in, and Mason and Dixon, no closer to having seen the site of the massacre, heads a-reel with smoke, return to their rooms. Does Britannia, when she sleeps, dream? Is America her dream, in which all that cannot pass in the metropolitan wakefulness is allowed expression away in the restless slumber of these provinces, and on westward, wherever 'tis not yet mapped, nor written down, nor ever by the majority of mankind seen? Serving as a very rubbish tip for subjunctive hopes for all that may yet be true. Earthly paradise, fountain of youth, realms of Prester John, Christ's kingdom, ever behind the sunset, safe till the next territory to the west be seen and recorded, measured and tied in, back into the network of points already known, that slowly triangulates its way into the continent, changing all from subjunctive to declarative, reducing possibilities to simplicities that serve the ends of governments. Winning away from the realm of the sacred, its borderlands one by one, and assuming them unto the bare mortal world that is our home, and our despair. Yet must the sensorium be nourished. Mason, insomniac, addresses himself in a sort of gastric speech he has devised for hours like these. As the body, with its own transcendent desires, the foremost being eternal youth, for which, alas, one seeks in vain through the enthusiast's fare that defines the Philadelphia Sabbath, the best offer heard being of bodily resurrection, which unhappily yet requires death as a precondition. He finds himself pretending Rebecca is there, somewhere, and listening. She is not visited since St. Helena. Mason cycles back to the island, a memory pilgrim with a well-marked itinerary map, to recapitulate exchanges in the ebony clearing, the empty walled patch, the lines at dawn before the Atlantic horizon. The next day he creeps out before Dixon is awake and goes to the site of last year's massacre by himself. He is not, as a rule, sensitive to the metaphysical remnants of evil. None but the grosser, that is, the gothical, are apt to claim his attention. Yet here in the soiled and strewn courtyard where it happened, roofless to his surveillance and to his judgment, prays Mason, he feels like a nun before a shrine, as he later relates it to Dixon, who has in fact slept till well past noon, as shifts and back shifts of bugs pass to and fro, inspecting his mortal envelope. Almost a smell, Mason quizzically, his face, it seems to Dixon, unusually white. Not the drains, nor the night's residency. I cannot explain. It quite torpedoed me. Sounds worth a visit. Acts have consequences, Dixon. They must. These louts believe all's right now, that they are free to get on with lives that to them are no doubt important, with no glimmer at all of the debt they have taken on. That is what I smelled, Lethe water. One of the things the newly born forget is how terrible its taste and smell. In time, these people are able to forget everything. Be willing but to wait a little, and ye may gull them again and again, however ye wish, even unto their own dissolution. In America, as I apprehend, time is the true river that runs round hell. They can't all be like that. Go and see, and damned if I'll share any more moments like that with you. As it suits thee. 'Tis how to suit myself, that's the puzzle. Quaker garb will send them into a warlike frenzy, whilst the red coat will strike them sullen and creeping, unable to be trusted at any scale. You might go as Harlequin, Mason replies, unsoothed, or Punch. Dixon has a fair idea of how little Mason cares for this continent. He himself has been trying to keep an open mind. Having been a Quaker all his life, his conscience early brought awake and not yet entirely fallen back to sleep, he now rides over to the jail as to his duty station, wearing a hat and coat borrowed of Mason. He is going as Mason. He sees where blows with rifle butts missed their marks and chipped the walls. He sees blood in corners never cleansed. Thankful he is no longer a child, else might he curse and weep, scattering his anger to no effect, Dixon now must be his own stern uncle and smack himself upon the pate at any sign of unfocusing. What in the holy names are these people about? Not even the Dutchman at the Cape behaved this way. Is it something in this wilderness, something ancient, that waited for them and infected their souls when they came? Nothing he had brought to it of his nearest comparison, Raby, with its thatched and benevolent romance of serfdom, had at all prepared him for the iron criminality of the Cape. The public executions and whippings, the opened flesh, the welling blood, the beefy, contented faces of those whites. Yet is Dixon certain as the lightness he feels now, lightness premonitory of flying, that far worse happened here, to these poor people, as the blood flew and the children cried, that at the end no one understood what they said as they died. "I don't pray enough," Dixon sub-vocalizes, "and I can't get upon my knees just now because too many are watching. Yet could I kneel, and would I pray, 'twould be to ask respectfully that this be made right, that the murderers meet appropriate fates, that I be spared the awkwardness of seeking them out myself and slaying as many as I may before they overwhelm me. Much better if that be handled some other way, by someone a bit more credible." He feels no better for this outpouring. Returning to their rooms, he finds Mason reclined and smoking, looking up guiltily from a ragged installment of The Ghastly Fop. "When were thou thinking of leaving this miserable place?" "My saddlebags are packed. I merely take the time waiting you to satisfy myself that the shockingly underaged Protasia Wafta has not yet succumbed before the wicked chemical assaults of the Ghastly F." "Whom are we working for, Mason?" "I rather thought, one day, you would be the one to tell me." "My bags are never unpacked. May we do this without haste, avoiding all appearance of anxiety?" "I am cool," Mason replies. In the instant, both feel strongly drawn by the forks of brandywine, Mrs. Harlan's bean pies and rhubarb tarts, the goose-down bedding, the friendliness of the milkmaids, the clement routine of observation. Gently, they disengage from Lancaster. Each milestone passes like another rung of a ladder ascended. Behind, below, diminishing, they hear and presently lose a voicing disconsolate of regret at their flight. Chapter 35. Facts are but the playthings of lawyers, tops and hoops forever a-spin. Alas, the historian may indulge no such idle rotating. History is not chronology, for that is left to lawyers, nor is it remembrance, for remembrance belongs to the people. History can as little pretend to the veracity of the one as claim the power of the other. Her practitioners, to survive, must soon learn the arts of the quidnunc, spy, and taproom wit, that there may ever continue more than one lifeline back into a past we risk, each day, losing our forebears in forever. Not a chain of single links, for one broken link could lose us all, rather a great disorderly tangle of lines, long and short, weak and strong, vanishing into the mnemonic deep, with only their destination in common. The Reverend Wicks Cherrycoke, Christ and History. "Why," Uncle Ives insists, "you look at the evidence, the testimony, the whole truth." "On the contrary, it may be the historian's duty to seek the truth, yet must he do everything he can not to tell it." "Oh, pish. Tush as well. 'Twasn't Mr. Gibbon's sort of history, in every way excellent, that I meant. Rather Jack Mandeville, Captain John Smith, even to Baron Munchausen of our own day, Herodotus being the godfather of all, in his refusal to utter the name of a certain Egyptian deity. Don't say it." "What? Seek the truth and not tell it? Shameful." "Extraordinary. Things that may not be told. Hadn't we enough of that from the old George?" "Just so. Who claims truth, truth abandons. History is hired, or coerced, only in interest that must ever prove base. She is too innocent to be left within the reach of anyone in power, who need but touch her, and all her credit is in the instant vanished, as if it had never been. She needs, rather, to be tended lovingly and honorably by fabulists and counterfeiters, ballad mongers and cranks of every radius, masters of disguise to provide her the costume, toilet, and bearing, and speech nimble enough to keep her beyond the desires or even the curiosity of government. As Aesop was obliged to tell fables, so Jacobites must speak in children's rhymes, as preachers do in parables sometimes. Cox, Pennsylvaniad, Book 10, of course. Hogwash, sir. Uncle Ives about to become peevish with his son. Facts are facts, and to believe otherwise is not only to behave perversely, but also to step in imminent peril of being grounded, young pup. Sir, no offense meant. I was but pointing out that a single version, in proceeding from a single authority. Ethelmer, Ives raises a monitory eyebrow, time on earth is too precious. No one has time for more than one version of the truth. Then let us have only jolly theatricals about the past and be done with it. 'Twould certainly lighten my schoolwork. Mr. Lisparks' fizz grows laden with menace. Or read novels, adds Euphrenia, her tone of dismissal owing more to her obligations as a guest than her real sentiments, engaged more often than she might admit with examples of the fabulist's art. As if having just detected a threat to the moral safety of the company, Ives announces, I cannot, damn me, I cannot, I say, energetically enough insist upon the danger of reading these storybooks, in particular those known as novel. Let she who hears heed. Britain's bedlam, even as the French salpêtrière, being populated by an alarming number of young persons, most of them female, seduced across the sill of madness by these irresponsible narratives that will not distinguish between fact and fancy. How are these frail minds to judge? Alas, every reader of novel must be reckoned a soul in peril, for she hath made a devil's bargain, squandering her most precious time for nothing in return but the meanest and shabbiest kinds of mental excitement.